Good morning, Council. Our next case is A24-1609, Peter William Bristol Malmstrom, petitioner, respondent, versus Dana Marie Kohlstock, appellant. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and Council for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal. Choose to use that. The podium toggles up and down. There's a switch at the front of it. This case is being live streamed, but we keep only a oral or audio recording for publication on our website later today or tomorrow. And Council, we are for appellant. We're ready for you. You want to take the podium? State your name and the party you represent for the record when you start your arguments, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sam Carusi, and I represent the appellant, Dana Marie Kohlstock. We're asking the court to reverse the determination of the trial court and remand for further proceedings as necessary to establish a more child-centered and less liberal parenting time schedule. In its original decision, at finding of fact 22, the trial court laid out numerous valid criticisms of the custody and parenting time evaluation. The perplexing part of this case is that in doing so, the court then made its own findings that seem to exacerbate these very problems that plague the custody evaluation. And I'll discuss a few of those as they pertain here. So first and most striking is that the court criticized the custody evaluation for, quote, in that quote, it recommended an expedited parenting time schedule without context or explanation. Now, the parenting time schedule that the court ended up ordering was a version of the recommended schedule, but expedited exponentially greater. For example, the custody evaluators recommended a gradual increase in parenting time over a 13-month period to a 50-50 schedule. While finding that the court or that the custody evaluators lacked credibility or that the report lacked credibility, the court then said, okay, for 2.5 months, we will immediately impose overnights. And then in month four, we skip immediately to 50-50. There's no explanation in the record
Why does the court have to have an explanation? I mean, district courts are given broad discretion in evaluating the factors. Is there a case law that says there has to be an explanation on why there is a graduation of visitation with time with dad?
So, Your Honor, especially as it pertains to this case, so there's not case law that requires that specific explanation to answer the court's question directly, Your Honor. What creates that obligation here and why it's an abuse of discretion that the court did not do so here is that the court criticized the expedited nature of the recommended parenting time schedule and then proceeded to order an even more expedited increase in parenting time.
But what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it, Your Honor, is that it's logically inconsistent. And logical consistency.
I think what your biggest argument is that the district court didn't accept the fact that there was an allegation of domestic violence, but that's the district court hearing all of the information and taking a look at the couple's therapy notes and recognizing that mom said no domestic violence, no issues. I mean, those are things that trial court hears. I mean, I think that's the thrust of your argument, isn't it?
That is certainly one of the areas in which the trial court erred, in our opinion, Your Honor. And I can certainly address that if the court would like to skip to that. As far as the domestic violence is concerned, Your Honor, you got to the heart of the court's analysis on the domestic violence issue, which was simply that at one point when the parties were doing
couples therapy,
mom filled out on a form that there was that father had not physically assaulted her or something to that effect. She then went into detail in her testimony about instances in which she feared imminent physical harm because of father's behavior. She was not under oath. They were in counseling to ostensibly try and make the relationship work. And that the difference between marking that form the way she did and the lengthy testimony where she testified about feeling afraid, and the court did find that these feelings were in good faith. The court did not state that mother was not afraid.
The court had made a credibility finding. And the court, we're a reviewing court, so we're not going to second guess. I mean, we can't step in and say, aha, yes, there was domestic abuse. I mean, how do we work around that?
Well, the court's credibility findings, Your Honor, were simply not based on the evidence. If the court's sole credibility finding was based on Ms. Kohlstock checking a form years in advance before, that doesn't adequately address the lengthy testimony she gave about specific instances in which she was physically afraid of father. And even assuming that the court did not err in its domestic violence finding, its order was not consistent with either the evidence or its own analysis of the custody and parenting time evaluation. And that was the crux of the argument I was making previously. So
I think the parenting time evaluation, I mean, the concern I have with your argument is the court said it gave little weight to the evaluator's recommendations and said it recommended an expedited parenting time schedule without context or explanation, and an analysis of best interest factors is minimal. Then it went on to analyze best interest factors, and it went on to decide its own expedited parenting time schedule. Why can't a district court do that? And if anything, it seems like what you would be asking for is a remand where it would have to explain why it did something different from the from the evaluator who's recommended. I mean, it seems to me that you're saying it can't do something that's close, the same or even more expedited than the evaluators, that it's barred from doing that because it rejected the evaluators. But that seems like a step too far, doesn't it?
It would, Your Honor, and that's not what I'm arguing.
Okay.
What I am arguing is that in holding that there were these specific critiques of the evaluator's report, the court then goes and makes those same mistakes, but even to a greater degree. So if the parenting time schedule was too expedited under the custody evaluator's report, the court introduced an even more expedited.
I don't think it says it's too expedited. It said it did it without context or explanation. So if
Correct.
Your argument to us is it repeated the same problem, it didn't give context or explanation here for its decision, aren't you asking for a remand to explain? I mean, what would be the consequence of not giving a sufficient explanation for a leave aside the parenting time thing? Now you're saying the district court in its own order didn't give sufficient explanation for its parenting time. What's the solution to that?
The solution, Your Honor, is for the court to make additional findings, but with guidance from this court. So one of the other issues that the court correctly found with the custody evaluator's report is quote the lack of follow up on mother's stated concerns, and that's really putting it lightly. In addition to the domestic violence concerns that mother testified to, she testified at length on some really disturbing photographs in Exhibit 109 that where she said I would find these marks when he would come back from dad's house. Those weren't discussed in any great detail or any great length in the order itself. There were a number of concerns that the court chose to ignore. So while the court does list out the best interest factors, the court does not conduct a thorough analysis of all of the relevant custody evaluation factors, and certainly not all of the evidence. There were disturbing photos and evidence that warranted at least a follow up.
Meaning, what does that mean?
At least further explanation from father as to how they got there. I believe the court made a finding that, you know, father sufficiently explained a few of the marks. He didn't. That father did not explain any of the marks in his testimony. He denied them. He claimed ignorance. He he did not explain them, and certainly not the most concerning ones in Exhibit 109, which the court did not address in any substantive detail in its order. And so it's even more concerning that the court found the way it did after. Now, the court does not go so far as to say that that there was bias on the part of the custody evaluators, but in finding of fact 20, the court discusses the interaction between Mr. Arnold and mother, during which Mr. Arnold became upset, pounded the table, and walked out of the room. The court said, quote, such an interaction could reasonably lead to the conclusion that evaluator Arnold's frustration with mother impacted the contents of the report and subsequent recommendations. I mean, that's saying bias without saying bias. And then I think where the abuse of discretion lies here is that the court then largely imposed and accelerated the custody evaluator's recommendations that itself acknowledges that it's based on bias without explaining why it did so. There's nothing about any expert testimony as to the age of the child that would have resulted in this accelerated schedule. There was nothing in there that the court could hang its hat on that would justify such an accelerated schedule. And to be clear, our position was and is that a 50-50 schedule is not appropriate. However, even if it were, the custody evaluator's report, flawed though it was, did a better job of imposing it in a more child-centered way and in a more gradual way that would allow the whole family to readjust. I'd also like to discuss, and I touched on this a little bit earlier, Your Honor, the staleness that the court noted of the custody and parenting time evaluation. The court could have but didn't order an updated evaluation. The court could have but didn't explain why it was stale or what about the stale evaluation would have warranted a departure from it to the extent it departed. Instead, it just implemented the same biased order and accelerated it to a really astonishing degree. So, the under the initial recommendations, the first month was to be every other weekend with no overnights. We don't get to the statutory minimum of 25%, which would have been about 4 out of every 14 overnights, until month 3 under the custody evaluator's recommendations. We start there under the court's order. The evaluator's recommendation then imposes just a little more, 5 out of 14 overnights. So that's just one overnight past generally considered the statutory minimum of 25%. With full implementation of the 50% schedule, 13 months into the graduated schedule. Here there was no lead up, there was no run up, in spite of the courts acknowledging that dad needed time to prepare and that the family needed time to prepare. There simply was not any explanation in the court's order as to why it chose to implement such an aggressive schedule, certainly nothing related to the best interest of the child. And for that reason, we are asking that the court reverse that determination. And if there are no further questions, I will.
Great, you'll have 5 minutes to rebut it. Can you remind me again, how do you pronounce your name?
Carusi, Your Honor.
Carusi, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
press the wrong button. There we go. Perfect.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Hennick. I represent the respondent, Peter Malmstrom, in this case. Excuse me. I was going to start out, and maybe I was confused by their brief, but they were requesting reversal, which to me seems different than what the request today was, which was a remand for additional findings. In their brief conclusion on both their brief and their reply brief, it says they wanted a reversal. So my argument was based upon that assumption, but today they're arguing something different.
Well, I think I asked something. I'm not sure they're arguing something different.
Well, perhaps. Maybe that was a better way to phrase it, Your Honor. I submit that the district court acted within their discretion, first on the custody labels that they assigned and granted. Appellant in their brief raises three issues on why the trial court erred, in that they are claiming that there was some improper either use or non-use of a legal presumption, either for or against legal custody, or for or against physical custody. And I think each one of those claims fails. So their brief, they argue that the court erred by not making a finding of fact on why they didn't use a legal presumption on the legal custody issue for legal custody, and then explain why that hasn't been rebutted. But the clearly reading of the statute indicates that the court isn't required to do that. So specifically, a court is required to apply a rebuttable presumption for joint legal custody, but only if either party requests that. So the statute is pretty clear. It says if somebody requests it, then the court has to use this joint legal presumption or for joint legal custody. And since neither party did, the court wasn't required to make a finding that says, I didn't use that presumption. They didn't because the statute didn't obligate them to.
Well, I want to understand the arguments and what you're saying about this. So when we're looking at B9 under 518.17. It says, the court shall use a rebuttable presumption that upon the request of either or both parties, joint legal custody is in the best interest of the child. You're saying there was no such request, so there shouldn't be a presumption of joint legal custody. And it says, however, the court shall use a rebuttable presumption that joint legal custody or joint physical custody is not in the best interest of the child if domestic abuse is found.
Sure.
And isn't it that second sentence that's more at issue here?
I think both are, but I think the second is as it relates to physical custody, because the first sentence I don't think says anything about physical custody.
Right. So first one is joint. Second one is legal.
Legal,
second one,
yes,
is legal and physical.
Correct.
And it says, what happens if there is domestic abuse? Then
Correct.
There's a presumption against. And the first one is if there's a request for joint, we'll presume joint's best.
On the legal custody
on
claim.
Legal.
And that's what I was starting with.
And is that the argument that the appellant is making?
He made that because he says the trial court did not make any findings whether the presumption against joint legal custody has been rebutted. So that's in his brief. So I'm...
Right. I think there is a rebuttable presumption against joint legal or joint physical custody if there's domestic abuse.
But again, that's my second argument, which is there's a framework in that second part of that statute section that you cite, Your Honor, that says if then. So if the court makes a finding of domestic abuse, then they have to employ this rebuttable presumption against, which counsel in their brief, I thought, argued that says the court didn't do that. Well, they didn't do that because the if part of that framework was not met. And we've identified that as the domestic abuse portion to this case, which I think is the crux of it. Appellant claims that somehow the court erred by not making a finding of domestic abuse. There's ample evidence to support the non-finding of domestic abuse littered throughout this case, and there are ample findings of fact that support the court not making a finding that there was domestic abuse. So I think the court did it just right. So on the legal custody issue, nobody requested that, no legal presumption for or against. On the physical custody and legal custody label, if there's no domestic abuse, there's no presumption against, which would require the court to say there's a presumption and then whether it's been rebutted. So the fact that those findings aren't there is immaterial. It doesn't impact this case and how this court, the trial court ruled. the crux of their case, I think, boils down to their claim that the court should have believed her on the domestic abuse claims. And as this court is well aware and has identified that that's not this court's purview, the court made credibility determinations, finding she wasn't credible on a myriad of facts. There were findings of fact that supported the there was testimony supporting that there wasn't domestic abuse. So appellant claims the existence of it. My client denies it both specifically and generally and testifies to each instance in which it was claimed to have occurred. There was documentary evidence that rebutted appellant's claim of domestic abuse, including the therapy record, which there was claims of domestic abuse in the month, in the 2 months before and the month before. This form was filled out in May of 2021 by the therapist, in which she takes a contrary position, saying that there was no domestic abuse, and then he wasn't a dominant partner. So you would think that's a reliable document, in my view. If you're going to a therapist, right, you would want to be honest with what the reason for the therapy would be. And so I think the court, in understanding that document, rationally took an adverse credibility determination against the appellant. Wait a minute, a month before you were claiming that this horrible thing occurred, which constitutes domestic abuse under 518B01. Then the next month, when you're seeking help from a professional, you say the exact opposite, that it wasn't occurring. And then throughout their therapy, it was never brought up, because incidents claimed to have occurred after the therapy began, and that wasn't raised either. My point is, there's documents in the record, in addition to my client's denials, both specific and general, which supports what the trial court did on the domestic abuse. It's clear that this is not and was not a case of domestic abuse. The court found that. That was their job. And all of there were other lay witnesses that testified, I know Peter. I've worked with him for a year and a half at Family Wise about his parenting skills leading up to this, and he showed no proclivity towards anything remotely violent or remotely that could be considered domestic abuse. And so we have appellant saying one thing, and we have a myriad of evidence saying the other, and the court rationally didn't find her credible. And so this court can't now come in, as you've identified, and say she was or make that determination. Appellant doesn't identify how the no finding of domestic abuse was illogical. That was a phrase in his brief. I don't know what logical leap the judge was supposed to do other than what she did, which was weigh and balance the evidence and make a finding. With respect to this exhibit 109, they make a claim that the court did not consider that. So 109 was pictures that appellant would take of the child upon his return to her care. And there were a myriad of people that looked at those and made a determination that they were not domestic abuse or inflicted by my client. And so at trial, my client rightfully testified that I didn't cause those marks or bruises, period. And it's important to look at their claim, appellant's claim, what she actually testified to. She testified that she was not submitting Exhibit 109, these pictures, to establish that my client, the respondent, abused his son. She's saying, I don't know what happened. Well, I don't know what happened doesn't meet the legal standard of domestic abuse under 518B01. And so she might have wanted the court to make some inference or logical jump that, of course, it occurred during his time and therefore he must have done it. But there was a myriad of other testimony that suggests he's a boy, he roughhouses with cousins, it wasn't an intentional act if he fell off the couch and you grabbed him, something like that. I don't know what the exact testimony was, but there was a lot of it that suggests that there was no intentionality to it, which is required under 518B01. And my client denied it altogether. I didn't cause that. I didn't do it. James is fine when he leaves me. And there were some that were testimony by appellant that she said, well, this happened, and I took this picture on a Friday. Well, my client hadn't seen the child for 2 days before, so the child was in her care for the entire time when the alleged abuse was to have been perpetrated. And so there were so many holes in the claims, and they were so flimsy that the court rightfully didn't find her credible on claims of abuse against herself and certainly against James. The claim that the court didn't consider Exhibit 109 is belied by the record itself, so the court said they did. All the evidence submitted, they looked at it, they admitted it as evidence. There was testimony on it that the court heard. Then when appellant submits proposed orders after the trial, which is customary, they were allowed to make arguments based upon that. I don't think the trial court has to say, well, I looked at this exhibit and I don't find it credible, and here's why. It's clear the totality of the record shows that they did do that. It was admitted into evidence, it was considered by the trial court, and it found though that not to be credible in the claim, as an appellant wanted to say that that supported the claim of domestic abuse against the child. There was Child Protective Services involved in this case that looked at those same marks and said that it didn't occur. There was a medical doctor that looked at this and said that that wasn't domestic abuse. Overall, there was just overwhelming evidence to support the finding that there was not domestic abuse perpetrated by my client against appellant or against his young son. Regarding the reliance on the custody evaluation, it's clear that they gave it little weight. And that was probably appropriate given the staleness of it and the length of time that had gone by between the recommendation and when trial ultimately occurred. I find it interesting that the claim now from appellant from this lectern was, well, they should have updated their recommendation. And if my recollection is correct, I think respondent, my client, wanted to allow those evaluators to do just that. That was opposed at the trial court level. But now on appeal, they say, well, court should have made them do that when they themselves rejected that approach. We wanted a more updated report. I think we either informally or formally asked for it, but I know for sure that it was they fought that approach. They didn't want anything further.
Is any of this in the record before us, what you're describing?
I think probably... I have to apologize. I don't remember whether or not we formally made a motion, which would be in the record, or whether it was at a pretrial level where there were discussions about settlement and this is what we think ought to happen. But I know it was contested, so my apologies if I don't have the specific site. But
it saves us time if the answer was no, it's probably not, then I wouldn't look for what you're saying. But if,
gotcha.
If you think it might be there, okay, and you don't know, that's okay.
The claim that the trial court appears to have relied on the evaluation and essentially adopted the recommendation, I think, is belied by what occurred. The claim the court gave little weight to that, and there was reason for that. And I don't think that's an abuse of discretion for the court to say, look, I've looked at that evidence, but I don't find it compelling. But I'll look at all the other evidence and make the appropriate findings of fact under the best interest factors. I didn't hear any cite to authority which says if the court makes a determination that's directionally the same as what an evaluator recommended, but we gave little weight, that somehow that's an abuse of discretion. The reason the court did it in such an expedited manner, you can tell from reading the findings, is that this court restricted my client's parenting time on the interim basis for about 2 years to really insignificant parenting time. And they did that based upon believing appellant, at least initially, on the claims of abuse. And now when they come to trial and the abuse claims are put to their full a burden of proof, and it's clear that there wasn't, I think the court said, wait a minute, I restricted this guy's time for this entire amount of time and this child's time with his father based upon you, appellant, making these claims throughout this process that I don't find valid, and nor did the evaluators, and nor did my client, and nor did Child Protective Services or a medical doctor. So I see my time is up, but I respectfully request that you simply affirm the trial court's order.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel. And counsel for appellant.
That's all right. May it please the court, counsel. So I'd like to start by addressing counsel's last argument. So counsel infers quite a bit from the court's order that just simply isn't there. There is no indication in the court's order why it chose to expedite this parenting time schedule. There is no explanation in the court's order why, after finding the custody evaluator's opinion unreliable because it ordered an expedited parenting schedule without context or explanation, why the court would then do the same thing but on an even more expedited basis. I'd also like to clarify, our position is that this court does not need to overturn the domestic violence findings in order to overturn the order writ large. Violence against a child, which these photos were offered for the purpose of proving that something is happening in Dad's home and I don't know what it is, but the child is in danger in Dad's home, is what these were offered to show. We don't know if he's falling. We don't know if Father is being physically abusive. What Ms. Kolstock testified was, after the child comes home, I notice these things and it scares me. And that's what she presented to the court, and the court ignored it. The court didn't find it to lack credibility. The court didn't find the photos themselves to be evidence of anything else. The court simply said, there's no concern. As to the myriad of people who looked at those photos, supposedly, and determined that there was no abuse, I'm not aware of anywhere in the record, or certainly at trial, in which any person, professional or otherwise, looked at those photos and then testified that there was no abuse of the child by the father. That evidence is lacking in the record.
I was wondering about that, and I apologize I don't know this about the record right now. Did the photo, there was an investigation by Child Protective Services? When did that take place? How does that relate in time to the alleged date of the photos?
So the photos are dated in the exhibit itself, and the photos span a great length of time. Off the top of my head, I don't know where specifically in that timeline the CPS report fell. Mother was not reporting to CPS. This was a report of a doctor, I believe, when she brought him in for noticing some marks on the child.
So, okay, so go ahead.
This was one instance. The record certainly doesn't show that Mom showed showed this litany of photos to the doctor. In fact,
the photos might have been of events happening at the same time that the investigation occurred, but there's not evidence to show that they actually saw those photos. Is
correct.
That right?
Okay. Correct. And I believe they predated and they occurred after as well. And Mom was not constantly on the phone trying to get CPS involved in a case that was already before the trial court. And we typically advise clients not to do that when we're in family court, because we lose control over the case, the judge loses control of the case, and it's a better way generally to protect the child. Having said that, Ms. Kolstock did raise these concerns. She raised them at trial. She raised them repeatedly at multiple points during this case, and she was circumspect in her language. Her goal was not to get you know, a TPR ordered. Her goal was not to get CPS involved. Her goal was to protect her son. And that's what she did. She took photos of marks that she found concerning, that she noticed, that she did not notice before the visit with Dad. She noticed it after. The court does not conduct an analysis of those photos, and that is crucial evidence in this case. And as to the presumption regarding domestic violence, our position is simply that the court erred in failing to find domestic violence.
Which would have led to a
presumption. Yes, that's correct, just to clarify that. And I see my time has expired, so unless there are no more questions, I will simply ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for your briefing, your oral arguments. The matter is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you.